Taylor Branch has joined us on Sports Byline. Again, I hope you'll look up the Atlantic and read the article by Pulitzer Prize-winning author Taylor Branch called The Shame of College Sports. The other thing that I've always noted is that you're asking educators, presidents, and chancellors of universities to try to discipline something that they really don't have any experience in. And you write in your article, educators are enthralled to their athletic departments because of these television riches and because they respect the political furies that can burst from a locker room. And I've often said that the colleges are really addicted to the television money. A, am I correct about that? And B, you think about it for a second, you got presidents and chancellors that are flying around probably on private jets to go watch their teams play on the road with alums, and they're trying to get monies for the university, not only their athletic program, but also for their academic areas as well. And so they're really caught between a rock and a hard place, and they can't deal with this. They don't have the skills to be able to deal with this.
Well, you're right. The moguls and the controllers of college sports now are increasingly the conference commissioners in the big conferences, the Big Ten, the SEC, the ACC, that are playing all these musical chairs for bigger and bigger TV contracts over a broader and broader region, because essentially those contracts give the schools and the conferences protection from the NCAA. The NCAA used to tell these football schools, you can't be on TV for a whole year, or you can't even play sports for a year. Nowadays, they have little symbolic slaps on the wrist, like we're vacating some of your victories. They wouldn't dream of doing the kind of things they did before, because the NCAA is rich but insecure.
Who is the gentleman that you referred to by the name of Friday? What was his first name, and what did he represent?
William Friday was my president at the University of North Carolina when I was an undergraduate back in the 60s. He was a respected, great educator in North Carolina, and he stayed there 35 or 40 years. And then he became the founder and the first president with Theodore Hesburgh of Notre Dame for two of the three Knight Commission reform initiatives. The Knight Foundation commissioned all these very prestigious bodies to try to reform and get commercialism out of college sports. One in 1990, one in 2000, and another one in 2010. And they are always coming up. Each one of them came up with reforms to reduce commercialism. And then 10 years later, they'd say, well, we enacted the reforms, but things have gotten worse anyhow. Mm-hmm. So Friday is a very weathered, wonderful idealist. I'll always love him, but he's very frustrated that college presidents and universities don't seem to be up to, as you say, handling this the problem of passion in sports.
He gave you a very interesting quote that goes along with backing up what I said about television being the tail that wags the dog when it comes to college sports. He said, we do every little thing for them. We furnish the theater, the actors, the lights, the music, and the audience for a drama measured neatly in time slots. They bring the camera and turn it on. There is an imbalance here in the relationship
yes,
between...
And he was still smarting when I went to see him, because the TV network had decided they wanted to televise a Carolina football game a year or so ago on a Thursday night. And he said, we had to shut down the whole university at 3 o'clock in the afternoon to help accommodate the crowds, so that we're really the tail of the dog, and we're supposed to be a great university. And also, he said, we're supposed to be a great university of free and independent thought, but amateurism and the economics of our own university and sports is one subject that's kind of forbidden around here. So in many respects, it's made universities betray their own first principles, to be honest, about education.
The imbalance between television and the universities, is that ever going to get better, or do you see the genie out of the bottle in that area?
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I mean, a long-term recession affects everything, and we never thought there would be an end to the Internet bubble or the housing bubble either. And maybe there's a bubble in this, but the passions that support college sports are very strong. I got to go to the Alabama-Auburn game with Cam Newton, and I grew up in Georgia. I was recruited to play football in the SEC almost 50 years ago, Well, I knew that it was passionate, but I hadn't. It's really changed a lot. I was just amazed at the passion at the Alabama-Auburn football game last year. There were people who had tailgated in their RVs for a week or 4 or 5 days, and they didn't even have tickets. They didn't get to go in the game. They just watched the satellite TV in a parking lot, and they could hear the roar in the stadium. And I interviewed these people saying, you know, why would you do this? Why wouldn't you just stay home and watch it on TV? And they looked at me like I was crazy, that I didn't understand why it was heaven for them to be there listening to the game, you know, half a mile away.
I think it's fair to say that the term student-athlete is archaic now, and it was deliberately ambiguous, was it not, when they laid out that term? Because you say college players were not students at play, nor were they just athletes in college, that they were high-performance athletes meant to be so they could be forgiven for not meeting the academic standards of their peers, that they were students meant that they did not have to be compensated ever for anything more than the cost of their studies.
This was one of the revelations that began to really open my eyes, and it, quite frankly, it upset me a lot. The main architect of the modern NCAA himself, Walter Byers, wrote that they coined the term student-athlete in the early 1950s to help the NCAA and colleges defend against workers' compensation lawsuits by football players who break their neck on the field. And the universities didn't want to have to pay medical care or any expenses for them, so they essentially said, you're not our employee. You got hurt more or less the same way of your own volition, like if you were throwing a Frisbee on the campus ground. We have nothing, no responsibility for you. You're a student athlete. And they created, and they repeat this phrase endlessly. If you ever hear an NCAA official do an interview, it's like a student athlete is a special creature that they're in charge of, that doesn't have the rights and privileges of ordinary American citizens. And, to hear that the whole purpose of codifying it and embedding it in all the NCAA regulations was to help the universities not take care of athletes that get hurt playing for them on football fields and earning money for the university was a sobering revelation for me.
Taylor, you make the point, if anything is going to correct this problem in this situation, it's going to have to come from two sources, and maybe collectively both sources at the same time, and that is a legal judification on this, and also Congress. Explain a little bit further what you think might happen in both those areas.
Well, there are many lawsuits now percolating in the courts trying to test the basic foundations of the NCAA cartel that sets up this artificial economic structure. There are antitrust suits because the NCAA is selling old film footage and new video games using ex-athletes, and the ex-athletes are saying, well, even if we were amateurs a long time ago, we're not amateurs now. Where do you get off selling our old games without our permission and without giving us a share? Oscar Robertson and is a plaintiff. Ed O'Bannon, who was college player of the year at UCLA when they won the national championship in 1995, they are plaintiffs. There are a number of similar suits like this. Congress is investigating why the NCAA should be exempt from due process procedures in treating athletes. And also Congress wants a national football playoff, and even President Obama has endorsed that. And that's the NCAA's greatest nightmare, because they're afraid if there's a football playoff, they'll take March Madness. So there are lots of things percolating around. And, of course, another thing in Congress 30 years ago took the control of the American Olympic Committees away from the AAU. And the Olympics went from being more amateur than NCAA college sports to thoroughly professionalized. Today, Michael Phelps is a millionaire, and he swims in the Olympics, but he couldn't swim at his college swim team at Michigan. And it's something that the NCAA avoids because everybody said the world would end if the Olympics went professional, and they did. And, in fact, nobody noticed, and it seems to have enhanced its image rather than hurt it. So it is an obvious model for doing just what the Olympic committees did, which was to give the athletes a voting share and stake in their own performance on these Olympic committees, and the Olympics reformed, and they're healthier than they've ever been.
Taylor, I want to congratulate you on this article. It is just a wonderful article, a lot of good information that I think people can use, and I think they'll come away with a clearer picture about the state of college athletes and also college athletics. Thank you very much for joining us here on Sports Byline, Taylor.
I really appreciate it. It was a great adventure to study this colorful history, and I hope maybe something constructive can come out of it. Thank you.
Taylor Branch with us. Again, check out the article in The Atlantic by the Pulitzer Prize-winning author. It's called The Shame of College Sports, as he takes a hard look at the NCAA and its relationship with universities and student athletes. We continue across the country and around the world on America's Sports Talk Show, Sports Byline.